Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Let's talk.
John Brown. Whispers from Celtic Seas, the true meaning of ancient stories from Northwest Europe, looks at the legends of submerged cities, land-making witches, and sea-crossing bishops that may not be mere inventions, but echoes of real events. Whispers from Celtic Seas is the new book by Patrick Nunn, and Patrick joins me live on the line from that most Celtic of locations. Good morning, Patrick. How are you, and where are you, my friend?
Giles, it's really good to talk to you, and thank you for having me on Europe today. I'm calling in from beautiful sunny southeast Queensland in Australia. It's 7:30 in the evening here, but so not a problem for me, but it's really good to be with you. And yes, I know it's not a very Celtic location, but my heart is elsewhere.
But you say that, but we're talking about indigenous legends and myths, and nobody does a legend and myth, especially creation legend and myth, than the indigenous peoples of Australia, for example.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And this is where I really sort of cut my teeth as a researcher on ancient stories. We've got so many stories here about meteorite falls, about volcanoes erupting, about the ocean rising across the land that have been preserved in Australian Aboriginal cultures. And we can put numbers on these stories. So we can say, yes, they're 6,000 years old because we know when the volcano last erupted. Or we can say, yes, they're 10,000 years old because of this and this and this. So that's what really got me excited. And then I thought, well, why not put my mind and what I've learned to the Celtic stories that I learnt in my youth?
So, I mean, with a name like Patrick Nunn, I mean, presumably there is some Celt in you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. A bit of Irish and a bit of Scottish and a bit of everything but Welsh, really, I suppose.
Well, I make up the Welsh section as being half Scottish, half Welsh. And also, of course, in Spain, we have Galicia, which is the forgotten Celtic people. Bagpipes.
Oh, yes.
Bagpipes and all. So you know, and, you know, we look at the... Is it quite difficult to cut between, if you like, the neo-Celt sort of modern pagan look that everybody's got a wind chime shudder and everybody's got a dream catcher in their car, and we sort of mix up our mythologies and take, you know, it's not a one size fits all, and it's a bit more complex than merely, you know, putting a bit of green and a braid and wearing some sort of tartan because you think it looks good on you.
Hey, look, I'm not going to disparage anyone and anyone's expression of what it means to sort of be Celtic or part Celtic. I'm a scientist. I'm a geologist by training and a climate scientist more recently. This is, you know, my bread and butter is in the hard geosciences and the climate sciences. I'm interested in applying my understanding of the past to the stories of the past, and trying to demonstrate that these stories are not simply fictions, but actually, in almost probably every case, they are based on actual events that people observed, but people couldn't read and write. So when they observed these things, they encoded them into memorable stories and passed those stories down through time, sometimes across thousands of years to get to us today.
When we're looking, because, I mean, again, we seem to, and you will know this obviously a bit better than anybody else, we seem to think that these stories are, and here comes the pun, set in stone, i.e. nothing changes, the landscape doesn't change, there are no seismic events. Well, we only have to look tragically over the past couple of weeks to see that actually landscapes do change and there are seismic events still happening. But if you don't have the vocabulary, if you like, to express what you have seen in your own eyes, then a village falling into the water because of a landslip or something bigger can be, if you like, it can be transferred into something more mystical.
Absolutely. Let me give you a really good example as quickly as I can, and that's about giants. So most coastal cultures in the world have giants as part of their mythology. And I think that stories about giants – probably came into being a few thousand years ago, when people were trying to explain that in the past, these two bits of land that today you see separated by ocean were actually joined. So people could actually walk from one landmass to the other because the ocean surface was lower than it is today. Now, as you tell that story after the ocean has risen and filled the gap, as you tell that story, it becomes less and less, people tend to doubt it more. And so they think, well, I don't believe that story. So you have to make the people who once walked between the two into giants. And when you look at the Irish Sea, when you look at islands, smaller islands off the coast of Ireland, off the coast of Scotland, even off the coasts of Brittany and Galicia, these are places where giants were once said to reside. And the origin of those giant stories lies in the post-event rationalization of people crossing between two landmasses that are today separated by water, but which in the past were joined because the ocean surface was lower.
Just apropos to nothing, if I was to stand on my desk, you got a rather splendid view of my ankles. But the other thing is the fact, and I know it's not Celtic, but we are 30 minutes from Gibraltar. And of course you have that. And of course we have the Pillars of Hercules. And that is a landmass that obviously the Mediterranean came into being when, and it must have been quite something to be standing there when the first waves came over. But, you know, previous to that, there was just a huge landmass where, you know, people could travel from Africa into Europe. So therefore...
And there was a massive lake, absolutely, and you had all sorts of things crossing from between Africa and Europe, and that's why you get pygmy hippopotamus in Malta and places like that, Cyprus.
Indeed. Right then, so but let's get back to the crux of, because I will go off on a tangent all day. That's my storytelling bent. So those are the way they explain a giants. What else are we looking at here? Witches are always, you think Celtic mythology, you've got to have a giant sort of lurking across the water, and you've got a devil's causeway or two falling in there, but you're not a proper Celt without having a somebody hubbling and boiling, preferably in threes, but if not, then just a solo hag. So what's the hagography, Patrick?
Well, the hagography, there's a few witch stories, not perhaps as many as you might think in my book, but, you know, certainly one of my favorite concerns a witch called the Gaia Carleen. And she lived in Scotland, and Sir Walter Scott considered her to be the mother of all the Celtic witches. And she was, by all means, a very evil person. And she once came down to the edge of the Solway Firth, which is on the border between England and Scotland. And she, a big wave came in and drowned a lot of her horses, and she got so angry that she held out her stick, her magic wand, and she actually commanded the water to rise and actually drown that part of the coast, basically create Solway Firth. Wow. And when you look at the details of the story, you can see that it plausibly refers to events that took place 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And there are all sorts of folk rhymes and poems that you know, also probably date from that era in that place and actually recall the same kind of thing. So, you know, I very rarely in the book look at just one source of information to justify a particular interpretation of a story. But when you scratch around, you can actually find there's an awful lot.
How much, because you're looking at, if you like, you're looking at the the geology of this and almost the archaeology. Is there somewhat of a problem? Because I'm just thinking about when people go on and they go, for example, looking for Solomon's Temple or, you know, and all that sort of stuff, and they try and fit the story to whatever they find, the archaeology. Is that something of a problem that you might crop up against when you're looking at sort of Celtic, you know, Celtic myths and stories and saying, okay, I'm going to try and fit the geology, archaeology to this story I've had of a giant, of a witch, of a seafaring bishop, or is it the other way around?
It's the other way around.
Right.
And I tell you why, because when you look at, let's say, the last 20,000 years of Northwest Europe,
yeah,
there are some places where the ocean surface has risen relative to the land, and there are some places where the ocean surface has fallen relative to the land. because the land has gone up. And if you look at the stories from those two contrasting contexts, you don't find one contradiction. All the stories from the submerging coasts talk about lands that have been lost beneath the ocean surface. And all the stories from those coasts, mostly in Scotland and Scandinavia, I know it's not Celtic, but in Scotland, they all talk about the land rising and more land being created. So there is a perfect fit between the geographical location of particular story types and what actually happened. And what I say in the introduction to my book, very quickly, nothing is represented in this book as fact, which cannot be scientifically verified. Right. And that I pride myself on. I'm not here writing some kind of fantasy for to sort of get people excited for an evening. I'm hoping to sort of actually make an impression that what we often subordinate as myths and legends are in fact echoes of real things that happened in the past.
Because if you look at it, if you look at, for example, I know you might have to go on to about the Scandinavians, and I know that's not, I mean, that is obviously, it's a different lore, if you like, L-O-R-E, but looking at the Icelandic sagas, because they're the ones that are written down in the, what is the 11th, 12th century, that is the creation of, and when you know the geology of Iceland, because it is a volcanic area, so therefore the creation of new lands is going to be, you can go, right, well, that fits with that exactly. Is there the same sort then of, the Scandinavians have the sagas. Do the Celts then have their sagas that have been written? Or is it, who's writing this down? Is it sort of like bored, tonsured monks in some godforsaken, and I use that word advisedly, monastery, thinking, I'm gonna spice this up with a couple of nymphs, I think, because it's been a while since I last saw my last hag.
No, it's not.
That was such a lead up, Patrick, and everything.
I'm not going to say something like that. But no, it's not. I mean, these stories, when you put a story into an oral condition and you pass that down over generations, and in Australia we have stories that have been passed down for 400 generations without the essence of those stories being lost, and all I'm doing is applying the same model, if you like, to Celtic stories and saying, look, you may not instinctively want to believe that Celtic stories have been passed down for 300 or 400 generations across several thousand years, but it is possible, okay? And if it's possible, then we should stop treating these stories as fiction, and we should start considering, can they actually tell us something about Celtic pasts that we didn't already know?
Where are you finding these stories, by the way? I mean, are they pretty much... I mean, how do you get the original sources of that? Because again, they're tales, they've been embroidered. Where is, if you like, the mother node for you to begin your research on these?
I suppose, the mother node in that sense is books written in the second half of the 19th century. So anything between 1850 and 1900,
right.
That is a magnificent source of information, whether you're in Scotland or Ireland or Wales or England or Brittany. You had a lot of scholarly people, right, who were concerned that the oral traditions of the non-literate were disappearing under this tsunami of literacy. As soon as people learn to read and write, they're not bothered about information that can't be read or written. Okay, suddenly oral knowledge goes out of the window. And today we talk about how unfortunate it is that some people can't read and write. Well, let's consider that perhaps they have something even better.
I never thought of it that way, Patrick. Because, yeah, if you suddenly you're reading and writing, then the oral traditions that have been passed down for generations have gone out the window. Absolutely. Because you don't need to remember, because it's written down.
That's right. And sometimes those oral traditions, they become ridiculed. I use the term Disneyfication in the book on one occasion. People make cartoons out of these things. So stories about Atlantis and things like that, and, even The Little Mermaid. I mean, these these all originated, in my view, as memories of particular events. No question.
You mentioned that because when you said these are written down and before you actually qualified the fact that this is the research document. Because when I think about 1800s and writing down, and you mentioned Sir Walter Scott, I'm thinking Mort d'Arthur. I'm thinking that great sort of Arthurian legend, and that, you know, and then we are in the lands of sort of, not quite Holy Grail, but you see what I'm saying here. It all becomes a bit sort of, look, a shoe and a lake and a whole thing. I mean, and you talk about Disneyfication, but there is that romanticism, isn't there, that we get? And they are, yep. There are sort of life. I mean, little mermaids are not nice things to come across in the wild.
Look, there was a parallel tradition to the Mort d'Arthur and Tennyson, the romantic tradition. And that parallel tradition was by so-called antiquaries, often clergymen, people like that, who actually took it upon themselves to write down what people told them, you know. And there's a lot of examples like that in the book. One of my favorite is Alexander Carmichael. He was a tax collector in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, where he came from in the 19th century. And he went from village to village, from community to community. And he really wasn't that interested in tax, but he recorded so many stories and he produced volumes and volumes of these stories. I don't know. I just give you a
please,
quick sort of.
Please, I mean, I shall never look at tax collecting again in the Outer Hebrides. it's brilliant.
So in the year 1866, Alexander Carmichael, acclaimed today for his voluminous writings on the folklore of the people he visited, travelled to the Monarch Islands. They're just off North Uist in the Outer Hebrides. And he had the privilege of conversing with an aged woman named Mary Mackay, and he wrote, "This interesting little woman, so full of the curious lore of her sea-girt isles, described the nuns and their lives with such charming grace and vivid intelligence, and in such felicitous Gaelic, that the writer could readily imagine she herself was the last remaining link between them and us. And one of the stories that Mary Mackay told was when her islands, the Monarch Islands, were connected by land to North Uist. And that today is a 7 kilometer wide gap that goes down, 8 meters, 23 feet, something like that. And she had memories that probably go back several thousand years of when the two land masses were connected. And it was more than that. She could tell Carmichael the names of the people who had last crossed them, the names of the people who drowned trying to cross them, the names of particular landmarks along the way, and things like that. And this is exactly what we find in Australia, to be honest. We find that level of detail in a lot of ancient stories. So I think there are magnificent parallels.
And of course, it's Gaelic, isn't it? I mean, that's a language that's disappearing fast in that particular time of year, isn't it? The time period. So it's invaluable he's managed to get this down.
Well, absolutely, yes. Yeah. And there's so many stories about him. He used to cross fords between one island and another in the Outer Hebrides, and he was about 6 feet 8 tall, so he could wade through these fords that other people couldn't. And the local people used to call them Carmichael crossings.
Wow.
Because normal people couldn't cross them, but he could, and all the time sort of reciting the poems and the stories that had been told in his mind. And there's lots of people like that.
And presumably, if this is all tidal and the whole thing and the moon pull, there will be, in the early days, there will be cases where they see shadows of the old, the sunken settlements, and that, that adds even more, if you like, to the
absolutely. And I think off the coast of Brittany, the Atlantic coast of Brittany, off the Atlantic coast of Western Ireland, this is where you find so many stories about cities that can be seen through the waves. Of course they can't, or at least maybe they can, but they're not cities with spires and castles. But you've got to try and separate people's imagination from the fact that they are remembering something that once existed there.
So what was the spark that led you down this particular path?
I spent a lot of my career in the Pacific Islands and encountered people there who couldn't read and write, who couldn't necessarily communicate in English. but who had a massive store of information in their heads. It was well organized. And I always tell people there was one particular occasion when I sat down and I listened to someone for 3 or 4 hours. And it was though he was reading from a book that was open in front of him. And he was telling stories about the island where he lived and about the adjoining islands and the people at different times. And it was a flowing, beautiful narrative. But he couldn't read or write. And he had all this in his head. And that gave me, Giles, a new respect for pre-literate knowledges. You know, I think when we grow up in a literate culture, when we're educated to read and write, we are also learnt, we are also taught to actually consider people who can't read and write as unfortunate.
And also, there's got that, and here comes a huge leap, okay? But if you're in the Pacific Islands, Samoa, Fiji, etc., some island communities, so small islands with patches, they, you are in more communication with nature stroke the sea than you would be if you were on a landmass. Go to the Orkneys, go to the Hebrides, get ship. Again, same, okay, different part of the world. However, that tradition, because you hear these Samoan, you know, and it's that long line of people going all the way back, that long line of people, which they can, you know, quote and come out like that with.
The difference, Giles, is that people have been in Samoa for about 3,000 years at the most. People have been in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland for at least 14,000 years, the last 14,000 years. So during the last ice age, ice covered Scotland and the Hebrides, or most of the Hebrides. No one lived there. It was too cold. Okay, but when the ice melted, people started exploring almost straight away. And we've got settlements on some of the Inner Hebrides dating from about 14,000 years ago. So there is a difference, although I understand, of course, the principle is exactly the same.
What are you hoping that people are going to learn from your book?
I hope people will learn to appreciate that oral knowledge and the ancient stories that today we tend to dismiss as myth and legend actually had a different kind of origin. They had their origin in people's observations of what actually happened. So I think, you know, this whole idea of sort of, you know, taking your kids to the library and sort of saying, hey, read these myths, you know, they're all made up stories, they're great fun and all this kind of thing. I don't think our ancestors ever had time to sit around and make up stories. They were far too busy with the essentials of life. If you go back 7,000-8,000 years ago, people didn't sit around and make up stories. They actually recorded what had happened so they could communicate that to the next generation, and the next generation's chances of survival were optimal as a result.
The book is called Whispers from Celtic Seas, The True Meanings of Ancient Stories from Northwest Europe. It's by the brilliant Patrick Nunn. Listeners, you can go onto our virtual bookstore, click on the front cover, and it'll be winging its way to you. Patrick, if people want to follow you and say nice things in Gaelic or any other language to you, where can they find you online? Where can they find you online?
I have a website, patricknunn.org, O-R-G.
Well,
Patrick Nunn, one word.
Patricknunn.org to find you. The book is called Whispers from Celtic Seas. It's by Patrick Nunn. Patrick, it's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you this morning from us, this evening to you.
I've really enjoyed it, Giles. Thank you so much.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.